Welcome to American Family Focus on Pennsylvania Issues, a weekly program which discusses some of the happenings that are of concern to the family and those who hold traditional values in Pennsylvania. And now your host, Diane Gramley, State Director of American Family Association of Pennsylvania.
Probably this time of year, we think more about our independence than any other. As many nations in the world live under a repressive government with very few rights and freedoms, we have much to be thankful for as we celebrate our nation's birthday this year. And we can never forget that freedom isn't free, and we must be eternally vigilant to keep the freedoms that so many have died to protect. Mostly, we don't think about or even realize the struggles our founding fathers went through before they actually voted for independence from Great Britain. They didn't just wake up one day and decide to take on the only superpower in the world. Although modern-day history books refuse to acknowledge it, our founding fathers spent months, if not years, in prayer about English oppression and whether they should declare independence. In addition, how could a group of 13 colonies with no army, navy, or real government gain their independence against such odds? They knew their fate was in the hands of the Almighty. Our guest today is David Barton of Aledo, Texas-based Wall Builders. Thanks, David, for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This time of year, I think independence is foremost in our thoughts as a nation, but I think that we as Americans may have lost the true meaning of independence. I mean, because of what we see happening in our culture, independence and freedom mean something else than what our founding fathers thought of when they thought of freedom.
Yeah, it's a lot different today from what it was. John Adams, who was so much an intimate part of what went on, he said the general principles on which the fathers achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity. You can't say something like that today. Well, he was part of it. He knew. He saw exactly what went on, and that's his declaration. So we really have come to a point today where that we've lost a whole lot of what we used to just know as fact, because we just don't teach this stuff in our textbooks anymore.
Yeah, that's for sure. You know, as I was preparing for this, you know, I did some reading about how God laid the foundation even before that declaration was signed with George Whitefield with the Great Awakening, where he laid the foundation to where colonists would be prepared to unite and fight. Could you tell us a little bit about George Whitefield and how the influence he had on the 13 colonies?
Well, you know, Whitefield is another great example, because today he would blow the paradigm for what we think a preacher's supposed to do. When the Stamp Act came out in 1765 and America sent Ben Franklin as an ambassador to Great Britain to argue against the Stamp Act and say, this is bad policy, you really don't want to do this. It was not just Ben Franklin, it was Ben Franklin and George Whitefield who went before Parliament saying, this is a bad tax, this is a wrong thing to do to the colonies. And what's a preacher doing in front of the Parliament? But that was Whitefield. He was part of this all the way through. Whitefield was the guy that when he was in America in the First Great Awakening, he was encouraging the Americans to seek independence. He's British himself. He knew British policy, but he said, this is not right. You need to seek independence. So here you have Whitefield as a preacher, also very intimately involved in politics and what was going on in politics. And within that framework, Whitefield was seen as such a significant force in America that he died in 1770 before the American Revolution started. He died in Newburyport, Massachusetts. And when the American troops left out of Massachusetts to go fight the British, significantly, they stopped by the church where he was buried. He was buried in the basement of that church, and it was very common back then that you put ministers, famous ministers, in sepulchers, and they were available where you could go see that sepulcher. And literally, this is now 5-6 years after Whitefield's death, before those soldiers went out marching against the British, they stopped by that church, they pulled the lid off that sarcophagus thing in which he was buried, and they reached in and cut pieces of cloth off his burial robe. And they took that with them as an inspiration to remember why it was they were fighting the American Revolution.
Wow.
So, I mean, here you got Whitefield as the inspiration for the American Revolution. You know, we never hear that. In the same way, people like John Adams and people like Ben Franklin say that had it not been for Whitefield, there would not have been an American Revolution. And not only in the inspirational sense, but Whitefield was the first one to get the colonies to start cooperating with each other. They were very much like Europe in the sense that there were 13 states or 13 nations. There were not one nation. There were 13 nations. And we've seen the difficulty that Europe is having right now in ratifying a European constitution. You can't get Poland and France to agree on anything, and that's the way it was in the colonies. I mean, getting Georgia and New York to agree wasn't going to happen. Those were two different nations. But Whitefield comes along with a famous sermon called Father Abraham's Sermon and convinces Americans that they have all this stuff in common, they should work together, they should cooperate, and just like there's not going to be denominations in heaven, we didn't need to have the distinctions that we had here on earth. And that sermon really tore down the walls for so much of what was needed to be torn down so we could cooperate in the revolution. So Whitefield is a huge huge source. And to add another one to that, John Adams, when he was asked who was behind the American Revolution, he not only pointed to Whitfield, but he pointed to the Reverend Dr. Jonathan Mayhew, the Reverend Samuel Cooper, and the Reverend Charles Chauncey. So John Adams points to four preachers and says, this is the group that's behind American independence. You know, we don't even study those guys today, but literally, that's who they pointed to back then.
So John Adams, who was, you know, as you said, he was an 8-year-old boy during the Revolution. Was that
John Quincy Adams?
He was old. That's right. That's true.
His father and son involved in the Revolution.
Yeah, but yet they were. He was pointing back to four preachers as being the instruments to actually the war for independence.
That's exactly it.
The foundation. Wow. No, you don't read that in America's history books anymore.
We've gotten away from so much of what used to be common knowledge,
and
that's real unfortunate. I mean, if you look at any textbook prior to World War II, you'll find all this stuff, but we just haven't taught it in the last 50 years, and it's really changed the way we look at the 4th of July.
And the way we look at the entire country, because if we don't know what our true foundation is as a nation, how can we love that nation? How can we honor that nation if we don't know where we came from?
Well, you know, a good one even with the 4th of July is we consistently teach in America that the reason that we separated from Great Britain was taxation without representation, which is in the Declaration of Independence. But the problem is taxation without representation was reason number 17 out of 27 reasons they gave. And it's the only one we study today. The only thing we look at in the Declaration today is taxation without representation. And so most people get it in their minds that the reason that government is formed is for economic issues and economic reasons and whatever. Those guys had 27 listings of why they separated and formed an independent nation. And if we want to get real modern and contemporary, four of the listings for the grievances they had against Great Britain dealt with judicial abuses. They said, hey, we're tired of judges making policy. We're going to start our own nation where judges don't make policy.
That sounds familiar.
That sounds just like today. You see, but they had 27 issues. There were moral issues. There were religious issues. We had been abolishing slavery across several of the states, Rhode Island, and you had Connecticut, Massachusetts, and King George III struck down every anti-slavery law. He said, you can't abolish slavery. We'd been forming missionary societies like the one that was formed in 1761, the Society to Propagate the Gospel Among the Indians in North America. King George III struck down our missionary societies. I mean, there was a lot of reasons these guys separated from Great Britain. And here today, we think that economics is all government's supposed to deal with and it's all it's about, and that's why we separated. No. We separated for moral reasons, for religious reasons, for judicial abuse reasons. I mean, there was a lot of reason for why America came into being, and today we forget so many of those reasons, and we just think it's all about economics, which it's not.
We also forget that one of the first things the Continental Congress did was order 20,000 Bibles? Because they were there.
Well, even going back before that, what's kind of cool is the first thing the Continental Congress did was they opened with prayer. And it was not a regular prayer like we would have today. You know, we say a blessing over a meal and it lasts about 10 seconds. No. The opening prayer session in Congress ran almost 3 hours. And in that opening prayer session in Congress, not only did they pray, but John Adams said that they studied 4 chapters of the Bible that morning in Congress. And John Adams said that God so spoke to them in that Bible study and so built their faith that they believed they could defeat the British for the first time. So here Congress is opening with a 3-hour prayer session and a Bible study with 4 chapters. And then when we started running low on Bibles, yes, Congress ordered the importation of 20,000 Bibles from Scotland or wherever we could find them because, of course, Great Britain was embargoing everything that came from there, and that was our chief trading partner. So now we're short of Bibles. So Congress orders them imported. Congress during that time also paid for missionaries to go evangelize among the Indians because the British were trying to turn the Indians against us and use the Indians in really domestic terrorism. And so we were saying, no, we need to keep them brought to Christ and not have this domestic terrorism. Congress is also during that period when we got past the importation of Bible standpoint, we decided to print a Bible in America. And the first Bible ever printed in America in the English language is done by the U.S. Congress. And it was done in 1781. And it was done for the use of our schools is what Congress said. So you look at what Congress did in the Revolution in the way of just Bible and prayer. There's a lot of stuff. And if you want to just expand on prayer, there's 15 occasions where the Congress called the entire nation to times of fasting, humiliation, and prayer. And they were very, very, very specific in their request that let's pray for this, and look what just happened to George Washington, let's pray and fast about this. And then they would turn around after a few months and issue times of prayer and thanksgiving saying, hey, you remember how we prayed for George Washington? Look what's happened since then. So Congress is very, very active in religious activities and encouraging Americans to religious activities.
The government has been blinded, today's government, How can anyone look at history? You know, they're obviously the product of the public school system, so they don't get American history. Again, they don't have the foundation. They don't know where we came from.
Yeah.
But yeah, when you look at all these examples where they're, you know, you're talking about Congress doing this after the First Amendment. I mean, you know.
Well, this was before the First Amendment. But it's interesting that after the First Amendment was in place, they continued to do this. They continued to issue times of prayer. They continued to pay for the importation of Bibles, as when the Philadelphia Bible Society imported Bibles, James Madison released all the levies and taxes on it. You also had Congress continue to pay for missionaries to the Indians. As a matter of fact, Thomas Jefferson, as President of the United States in 1803, negotiated a treaty with the Kaskaskia Indians, and he used federal funds to pay for missionaries to evangelize the Indians. That was a treaty that was repeated time and time and time and time and time again. Andrew Jackson repeated that treaty. Abraham Lincoln repeated that treaty, sending missionaries to the Indians. So, I mean, we did it both before and after the First Amendment. You know, the first examples I gave were of Congress before the First Amendment, but the examples I'm now giving is Congress after the First Amendment. And, I mean, we just did not see the same things the same way. And that was because we actually knew our history. Because in the writing of the First Amendment, James Madison is the one who, when we wrote the amendment, he's credited with the First Amendment. He said the purpose is to prevent the establishment of a single national Christian denomination. Well, establishing the Baptists or the Methodists or the Catholics or the Anglicans now has been interpreted to say, oh, you can't say a prayer at graduation. Well, that's not establishing a denomination, but that's where we've headed, and we've gotten so far away from our history that it's unbelievable what we've allowed to occur in the name of the Founding Fathers, which actually is against everything that they fought for and did.
Yeah, and it's so sad. I mean, like you said, they fought for, and I mean, they died, and when these individuals, these 57 individuals, signed the Declaration of Independence, many of them, you know, the way they signed it, they pledged their sacred honor. They pledged all that they had, and many of them died in bankruptcy because they had helped fund the effort, the struggle for independence against Great Britain. And they, when they signed that piece of the parchment, they knew that it was something that they would honor and they would stick with to the end, no matter what it cost them. And it cost many of them very dearly.
Yeah, they paid a price for it. I mean, when they pledged their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor, that wasn't just rhetoric for these guys. Seven of them never lived to see what they had signed to be accomplished. I mean, just they were killed before that. We have 12 of them who lost their entire fortunes as a direct result of war. We have three of them who lost their kids to the British. We have three who lost their wives to the British. We have a bunch more. I was just reading a John Adams letter here this week where he was talking about how many of those who had signed died in poverty as a result of signing. And he said, even in my case, he said, I handed off my law practice to John Lowell. And he wrote this letter in 1811. So now we're talking at that point, 36 years after the revolution. And he said, I handed off my law practice to John Lowell, and he just died wealthy. And he left an inheritance that made every one of his kids wealthy out of the law practice I had. And he said, and I'm about to die in poverty. And he said, but that's a result of what we did for our country. And so even those who didn't lose every single thing they had in the Revolution still died very poor. Sam Adams died very poor. A number of the generals died very poor. Ben Franklin really financed much of the Revolution out of his pocket, as did Robert Morris, as did several others. So, I mean, they gave lives, they gave kids, they gave possessions, they gave income, they cost them over the rest of their life. I mean, these guys paid a price. And you know what I find most remarkable is out of the 56 who signed, we do not have one single example of anyone who went back on his word and found a cop out and said, well, you know, I'm tired of making the sacrifice. Let somebody else make it. I mean, there's not a single example anywhere in the American Revolution of not one of them turning back on their word. No loss of integrity anywhere. So pretty unbelievable group of guys.
That's
really
sure.
Fascinating stuff to see.
And yeah, God obviously put them in place, and they didn't desire to look for to find a loophole to get out of their signature on a piece of paper.
Exactly.
And as we're looking at the Declaration of Independence itself, and we're looking at some of what the founding fathers or the ones who are meeting together contemplating independence or declaring independence. I mean, you know, during all this, you know, the British oppression is becoming worse, and talking about the Boston Massacre takes place, Lexington and Concord, and still these individuals, prior to actually writing and signing a Declaration of Independence, they still try to reach out to Great Britain to try to get things settled. And they really want to make sure that they're seeking independence is in God's will.
You know, one of the things that they were very conscious of was the scriptures and how they had to conduct themselves. They went for 11 years of peaceful entreaty, of resolution after entreaty, what was called the olive branch petition, etc. They did that for 11 years. And they made sure, even at Lexington and Concord, the man who was in charge of Lexington and Concord was the Reverend Jonas Clark. And everyone who was shot down that day, there were 19 shot down at Lexington, they were all out of his church. And when Paul Revere rode to find John Hancock and Sam Adams, they were staying at the home of the Reverend Jonas Clark. And when they heard the British were coming, they said, "Reverend, are your people ready for this?" And he said, "I've trained them for this very hour." So the clergy were very involved, but there were two points that they thought were very significant. One is you cannot rebel against civil government. Romans 13 teaches that. One of the theological books on which the Patriots very heavily relied, John Adams and others, was called A Defense of Liberty Against Tyrants by Junius Brutus. It had been printed actually in 1689. So it was, you know, like 100 years old when they had it. And it was an exposition from the Greek of what the Greek says is the proper role of government based on Romans 13. And they felt like they could not violate the scriptures on that. The other thing that they felt was very important was that we cannot start a conflict. Now, the scripture teaches that if we get attacked, we have the right to defend ourselves, but we can't start it. And so there at Lexington that day, when the British lined up, Pastor Clark had trained his people, you cannot start this thing. Now, if they fire at you, you can finish it, but you can't start it. And so that's why 19 went down, is because he would not let them start it. The British started it. And he's got a great sermon that he gave the very next year, recounting what had happened on that particular day, on the one-year anniversary of that day. So they were very conscious that this had to be what they considered to be a defensive war. If it was an offensive war, if they initiated attack against Great Britain, they believed biblically God could not bless them. But once they got attacked, once they were fired on, that's a whole different situation, and they believed they could respond then. And so they got fired on there. They got fired on at the Boston Massacre. They got fired on the Concord Bridge. They made sure they weren't the ones who started it, and they used peaceful entreaty. And even after we had been shooting bullets for 2 years, they were still sending peaceful entreaty to Parliament, to the King, saying, "Please let us give you our grievances and see if we can't work this out peacefully." And finally, on the last petition they sent, with the olive branch petition, the King responded to their petition for peace by sending 25,000 armed troops to find and hang them. And at that point, it was off. Now, interestingly, they did not call it a revolution. They called it a civil war, because they said their own country had attacked them. But they were extremely conscious of doing this as best they could in a biblical means and biblical manner. And there were two books particularly that they used that were theological books that had a huge impact in how they conducted the revolution.
So they called it a war. They called it a civil war, not
theirs
a war.
It was called a civil war. Now, later it became a revolution and it wasn't in the sense that we mean a revolution today. They called it a revolution in that saying that now that we have left from Great Britain, there has to be a revolution of our thinking and of our manners and of our education and of our attitudes. And part of that revolution was an educational revolution. Folks like Noah Webster, who became the great schoolmaster to America, who had been a soldier in the American Revolution. I mean, Noah Webster said, "Hey, we're still attached to British books. The British government books the government books we have in American schools are still saying the king is the best way to have government, and we know that that's not right. We should have self-government based on Exodus 18:21. So the real revolution occurred after the military revolution. It was a revolution in our forms of government. We went from monarchies to representative republican governments. It was a revolution in the forms of our education, where that we began to educate purely American Americanisms. We even changed the way that we spelled our words. We dropped the U out of most words like honor, H-O-N-O-U-R, and labor, L-A-B-O-U-R, and savior, S-A-V-I-O-U-R.
Favorite,
so we went
favorite.
To an American system of spelling. So that was the real revolution, was following the military revolution. We went into truly changing the way we thought about so much.
So we Americanized the books. I mean, we Americanized the books, Americanized our spelling, so there could be a distinct break from Great Britain.
They were very conscious and very fearful that if we continued to use British education and British books and British everything, that we would get inculcated in British doctrine again, mm-hmm. and might be like the Israelites in Egypt and want to go back to Egypt. You know, after they had left, they said it wasn't so bad after all. Let's go back to Egypt. And to make sure that did not occur is why they worked so hard to Americanize education, Americanize spelling, Americanize our institutions, And we did. I mean, it didn't take very long. We became a unique nation.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time you get Alexis de Tocqueville and those guys coming to America, they call it American exceptionalism. There's nothing else like this in the world. This is an exceptional thing among men. So there is just a lot of stuff that they did in a short period of time. And that was the real revolution, was not the military, because, again, that was considered a civil war. These guys considered themselves very loyal British citizens. They thought King George III was violating the British Bill of Rights, which he was. I mean, literally, King George III died insane. And so their point was well taken. And Parliament, people like Edmund Burke and others, saying, look, we have written documents, and we're violating those documents with our own colonies. So it really was a civil war. If Great Britain had not made those violations, we would probably still be British citizens today. But having made those violations, that's where we made all the entreaty. And then that's where King George III became outraged and sent armed force and said, you're going to do it my way. I don't care what our Bill of Rights says. You're going to do it my way. And that's where the real break came.
Wow. But that is interesting that our founding fathers realized the impact that education would have on future generations if they did not deal with that English influence.
Yeah, you'll find that they started more universities in America in the 10 years after the American Revolution than they did in 150 years before the American Revolution.
Wow.
And that was that effort to make sure that we delivered American principles to all of our students, because we were a unique nation. And by the way, this is part of what they did with immigration. I mean, they were fairly wide open on immigration, but the requirement was you have to become inculcated in this system of thinking. You have to learn what it means to be an American, because there's a different form of government, there's different commitments. You have to commit yourself as a citizen to the culture and to the principles and to the values. And so, I mean, they were huge into education, whether it was domestically with our kids or whether it was others that were coming in as immigrants. And we had religious immigrants coming from everywhere. We had persecuted Jews from Portugal and persecuted Protestants from France and persecuted Lutherans from Germany. I mean, they were coming from everywhere, but we were huge into education. So, again, the fact that they started, and it was, by the way, it was the same founding fathers who fought in the Revolution that started all these universities and schools after the Revolution, because they knew how important education was.
Well, that is so, you know, that all speaks to today, you know, with the education issue, with the immigration issue. That speaks so much to what's going on today and
Absolutely.
How we need to get back to our roots as a nation. And because we're seeing, you know, we still have the documents, we still have the Declaration, we still have the Constitution, but we have people looking at those very same words and somehow reading in between the lines or just completely interpreting it a different way, but yet the documentation's there.
Yes, it is. It is there. The documentation is there, and the history is there too, but we really don't teach even history anymore. I mean, we have moved so far away from teaching history the way that we had taught it for years and years. And I was just talking with some educators recently, and, you know, we now teach that, for example, I mentioned earlier that we had this this thing in the Declaration where that four of the clauses dealt with judicial abuses. Well, we now teach that the three branches are co-equal, that the three branches are independent. We now teach that federal judges have lifetime appointments, and yet we absolutely forbid that in the Constitution. It's just that we don't know the language of the Constitution.
Yeah.
We don't read the Federalist Papers. The Constitution makes it real clear the branches are not co-equal. It makes it real clear the federal judges do not have lifetime appointments, Article 3, Section 1. But we don't read that. And so what happens now is we're teaching a bunch of nonsense that we've learned over recent years that really is not who we are as a people. And again, nearly every bit of this is coming in the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really kind of shaping a new America, which, you know, that may be good, that may be bad, but what's happening is we think we're doing it in the name of the old America, and that's just flat where we're wrong.
Yeah.
If we want to look back and say, you know, we don't like anything they did, we're going to do it totally different, that's fine. That's one debate. But to do it because we think it's the way it's always been, you know, that's where we're really missing on this, is we think we're doing this in the name of the Constitution, and that's really not the case.
And that is so sad.
And here we are on the 4th of July, and what the articles across the nation that I've seen say, you know, basically the religious character of the founding fathers were they were atheists, agnostics, and deists. And you go, no, wait, time out. We had 56 guys sign the Declaration of Independence, and 24 of the signers had seminary degrees.
Yeah.
Half these guys were preachers, and we're saying they're all atheists, agnostics, deists. Now, we keep that vision, and that'll convince us that we as mm-hmm. Christians shouldn't be involved in civil government, which is absolute nonsense.
Yeah, yeah.
But our history will help take care of that if we just go back and see who we are as a people.
Right. Now, if folks wanted to contact you, go to your website. What information? What's that information?
Information is worldbuilders.com, and then we have an 800 number, which is real simple, 800, the number 8, and the word rebuild. So worldbuilders.com or 800-8-REBUILD. And we can supply them with tons of original documents and information to see who we were as a people.
Okay. I sure appreciate that. So wallbuilders.com.
That's it.
Okay. Sure appreciate it. And then have a good 4th of July.
Thanks for having me. God bless.
God bless you too. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to American Family Focus on Pennsylvania Issues. If you would like to get involved in the efforts to defend traditional values in Pennsylvania, please contact the AFAFPA by writing to Post Office Box 1048, Franklin, Pennsylvania, 16323, or by visiting their website at www.afafpa.org.